All the news you need for your commute home. It's The Takeaway for Thursday, November 2nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today. Federal and local investigators are now hard at work trying to piece together the motivations, the connections, and contacts of the man who allegedly drove a rented truck down a bike path in Lower Manhattan on Tuesday, killing 8 people and injuring 12. And that question, why, is one that hangs over not only this deadly mass casualty attack, but others, not with religion at their root, but some other twisted, maybe unfathomable motive. Finding the motivation for crimes behind mass casualties can be incredibly difficult for authorities. That also appears to be the case in Las Vegas. And we'll return to that city 1 month after the mass shooting at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, coming up in just a few moments. But we begin today with this most recent attack in front of investigators now. There's still a lot that we don't know about Saifullo Saipov, who came to the United States from Uzbekistan in 2010 and is now suspected of Tuesday's truck attack. How deep were his connections to ISIS? Investigators say he left behind evidence suggesting that he may have been influenced or inspired by the terror group. And authorities have now found a second Uzbek man they're seeking in connection with the investigation. Meanwhile, President Trump suggested on Wednesday that Saipov should be sent to the Guantanamo Bay detention facility.
I would certainly consider that, yes. I would certainly consider that. Send him to Gitmo. I would certainly consider that, yes.
Now, Saipov is a legal permanent resident in the United States. Sending him to the military prison at Guantanamo Bay would be unprecedented. The president also has a verdict in mind already. On Twitter, he said Saipov should get the death penalty. Erica Marat is a Central Asia expert at the College of International Security Affairs at the National Defense University. She's here to talk about what we know so far about the alleged attacker's origins and motivations. Erica, thanks for being here.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, what's the latest that we know about the attacker and his motivations that would be important to investigators at this point?
I think we're investigating whether he was radicalized here in the United States or before he came in 2010. And it will take quite a lot of time to really understand what were his grievances, what took him to commit this act of terror. And a lot from his personal life will need to be analyzed, and his just ability to fit in the Western society.
Now, you mentioned that investigators are going to be very interested in whether Saipov was radicalized in the United States, where he's lived for 8 years, or back home in Uzbekistan. What's the climate like there in Uzbekistan, in Central Asia? Does ISIS have a lot of influence? And are U.S. counterintelligence officials concerned overall about radicalization there?
Uzbekistan, as part of Central Asia, has seen a growing level of radicalization, mostly among younger men who went and joined ISIS in Iraq and Syria. However, the level of radicalization is nowhere compared to other Muslim majority regions. And the suspected attacker himself comes from a capital area, from an urban area where you don't really see that much extremist use supported by the population. So it is really hard to say. He might have been exposed to some radical idea. And remember, he came here in 2010 before ISIS claimed so much fame around the world. But I think we really have to see what happened to him here in the United States, why he felt like he was, you know, ready to commit this act of extremism.
Erica, the attack itself, whether ISIS does have responsibility for it or it was inspiration from their rhetoric online, what does it say that the attack was really quite rudimentary and sort of ad hoc, a rental pickup driven on a bike lane, no additional weapons left behind? What does that say to you?
I think it says that he didn't really have that much access to other ISIS supporters here in the United States. The planning was all happening probably in his own head. Without much support, and these are my speculations, but it's a poorly planned attack. And although lives were lost, I think if he were to communicate with ISIS or a larger cell of extremists here in the United States, the level of casualties would have been higher.
So, Erica, investigators are interrogating Saipov, of course, counterintelligence and law enforcement. The president of the United States said yesterday during a photo op that he thought Saipov should be sent to Guantanamo, to Gitmo. Now, I mentioned that he's a lawful, legal U.S. resident in terms of his immigration status. If the president is serious that this is U.S. policy and will be, and we don't know that he is, what would it mean for Saipov to be sent to Guantanamo Bay?
I think, frankly, the type of rhetoric coming from the president and his administration is quite extreme as well. I think it's divisive. It doesn't help communities come together and cooperate with law enforcement. It increases the level of distrust among minority groups, and it might just legally be unattainable. So it is unfortunate rhetoric. It's the time when we really need to try to help communities cooperate, identify potential extremists, and just try to understand why is this happening here in the United States, and the president is nowhere to help here.
Erica, as investigators on this attack go forward with their investigation and their interrogation, what's most important for them now?
To investigate his professional work, his personal life, any encounters with law enforcement or violent behavior that he had, whether he was ready to go back to Uzbekistan if he failed here in the United States. It is meticulous. It is not an easy answer. But again, the more we understand, the more hopefully we'll be able to prevent future attacks.
Erica Murat, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Erica Murat is a Central Asia expert at the College of International Security Affairs at the National Defense University. National attention this week is focused on the attack on pedestrians and bikers in Lower Manhattan. But Tuesday also marked 1 month since the Las Vegas shooting, and lots of unanswered questions remain.
We located numerous firearms within the room that he occupied.
There's no manifesto and no clear reason of why he did what he did.
We're angry. We're grieving, we're confused, people are hurting.
There is still very little known about what motivated gunman Stephen Paddock. The shooting at a country music festival left 58 people dead and hundreds injured. Meanwhile, as the investigation goes on, there's been almost no legislative response from Congress in Washington. Congresswoman Dina Titus is a Democrat representing Nevada's 1st congressional district in Las Vegas. She joins me now. Congresswoman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you now know about the motivations or planning of Stephen Paddock that led to this shooting? Has there been any new information that investigators have shared with you?
Not really. I'm not sure we'll ever know his real motives. There's no indication it was ideologically driven, that it was affiliated with any international group. We know it was very meticulously and deliberately planned. The investigation has gone from an international one when they were looking for his girlfriend in Asia down to something much more narrowly defined. So we'll get more information about the incident, but I doubt we'll ever really understand the motivation.
Well, Congresswoman, are you dissatisfied with the pace and the breadth of the investigation? Or do you have a sense that maybe there isn't much to know, that maybe he truly told no one about his plans and just hid it?
Well, I have to say that our law enforcement locally, working with the FBI, is being very careful. They want to get all the details, and I think they're doing a good job. Better to be a little bit longer and later than to rush to judgment and have to correct something down the road. I feel for the victims because they want to know why this happened. And also just the general public, when it can be somebody who's your next door neighbor that nobody suspects or knows anything about, then that makes you a little more scared in everyday life.
Meanwhile, in Washington, Congresswoman, there has been basically no legislative response coming from Congress. That might not be much of a surprise. This is a body that didn't respond legislatively after Newtown or other disastrous shootings. What are lawmakers saying about the climate? In particular, what are your Republican colleagues, who I know you talk to, saying to you?
Well, right after the incident, of course, there was a lot of flurry and there was a moment of silence on the floor and there was talk about banning bump stocks. Then Speaker Ryan started to back off of that and said, well, maybe we should leave it to the ATF to regulate bump stocks. Well, the ATF has said under existing law, they don't have that authority. So we have moved from banning bump stocks to taking a different direction with a bipartisan bill giving the ATF that authority under the bill that was passed, the National Firearms Act, way back in 1934.
You've introduced that bill. It's bipartisan. You and I and many listeners, Congresswoman, know that a bill introduced is not a bill passed or a bill signed. What are the prospects, and what are the prospects for the NRA or other lobbying groups working to kill it?
Well, the NRA is definitely working to kill it. They feel like anything that looks at gun violence is a violation of the Second Amendment. I'm a gun owner myself, and I don't feel that way. This is just sensible. It's reasonable. It uses existing law. But they are certainly against it, and they will pressure the Republicans like they always do. You know, they just hope they can wait you out. We'll forget about it. The news cycle will change, and we'll move on to the next incident where we have another moment of silence and nothing gets accomplished. I think, though, nationally, we've got to be reaching a tipping point. If you look at polls, people across the country, even in Nevada, which is the Wild West, support background checks. And at that concert, there were 22,000 people, and all of those people are connected with families and friends. So more and more people are starting to say to the NRA, this is unacceptable. You've got to take some kind of action.
Congresswoman, let's go back to your hometown. Let's go back to Las Vegas in the moment we have left. How is Las Vegas doing? I wonder if people in town feel in some ways like the country has moved on while they still remain with the pieces of this awful tragedy. How are they feeling?
Well, we'll never be the same, but we're strong, we're resilient, we're healing. I say to the rest of the country, if you want to help us heal, don't cancel your trip. You know, Las Vegas came together as a community like never before, and then the worst of circumstances. People tend to think of us as just Disney World for adults, but it's true that we are real people. We go to real schools, real churches. We give blood, and if you saw the doctors and nurses and first responders and just silent heroes, it was pretty amazing.
And that's what people in Las Vegas need now. They need tourists. They need us to come spend a dollar in the casino or at the show.
Well, that's right. That's how we keep going forward. We've got to be sure, though, we never forget the victims. And there are some who are still in the hospital who are very, very seriously injured, whose lives will be changed forever. We don't want to forget them. But we are gathering a lot of money. A lot of donations have been made to a victims fund, in addition to all the blood that was given, the food drives, just an incredible outpouring of generosity from the people of Las Vegas. So
yes.
Come help us.
Congresswoman Dina Titus, Democrat of the 1st District in Las Vegas. Congresswoman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Tax Cut and Jobs Act will deliver real relief for people in the middle, people who are also striving to get there. With this plan, the typical family of four will save $1,182 a year on their taxes.
That is Speaker of the House Paul Ryan today in Congress announcing the House Republicans' long-awaited tax plan. Colleen Murphy is a Capitol Hill reporter at Bloomberg Tax, and she's on the Hill now in Washington, D.C. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Boy, you know, Paul Ryan spent some years as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and he never achieved the fantasy of tax cuts like this. This is a big day for him.
Absolutely. House Republicans are very excited, and it's been definitely a long road for them to get here. We saw the rollout of this bill be delayed one day earlier this week as they were sort of making finishing touches. And we were here in the Capitol until about 11 o'clock last night waiting for them to wrap it up.
Took them a day longer than they expected to get it out. All right. So the corporate rate, which the president has been talking about a lot, cut from 35% to 20%. So corporations get a big break. Let's talk about regular people, income taxes, and the new brackets. What are people going to be paying?
That's right. So there are they've set three main tax brackets, and then they are including the top 39.6% tax bracket. So these brackets are set at 10, 15, and 25%. And then Republicans, like I said, kept that top bracket on households earning more than $1 million.
All right. So a lot of these details and so many more are going to get negotiated, voted on, probably negotiated with the Senate before it's all done. But Colleen, Speaker Ryan made a statement at the top there. He said the typical family of four will save $1,182 a year on their taxes. Does it wash?
Well, that's definitely what they've been pushing. And I should clarify again, sorry, on the brackets, it's 12%, 25%, and 35%. Something that Republicans have also included in this bill that is a big selling point for the middle class, as they're putting it, is no changes to 401k plans. So we had been hearing for the last couple of weeks that they might cap the amount of money individuals can put in pre-taxed their 401k. That is not included in this bill. They will definitely be pushing that as an example of how they're helping the middle class. And then we have some other provisions like a doubled standard deduction, a larger child tax credit, which they are going to be definitely using to sell this as, you know, a boon for the middle class.
A middle class tax cut. Meanwhile, it is obvious, though, that the majority of the benefit not only goes to that corporate tax cut that we talked about, but tax cuts at the very top of the earning tree.
Yeah, and there are two other provisions in here that are going to get a little bit sticky in the next couple of weeks, and that's they are capping the amount that of state and local taxes that you can deduct from your income at $10,000. That's part of this compromise they've been working out with Republicans in high tax states. They're also capping the mortgage interest deduction at $500,000 instead of $1 million for new mortgages, and those are definitely going to be pretty controversial. The National Association of Home Builders has come out against this bill, and they, you know, have been pretty vocal the last couple of days about how these provisions would impact them. So those are two, I think, to definitely keep an eye on, both in terms of what they would mean for individuals and families, but also in terms of how these negotiations play out in the House.
Because an army of tax lobbyists is about to descend on Capitol Hill. Hey, look, they probably have already to get this bill written in the House. But Colleen, they're going to have a Senate bill. They're going to negotiate those two things. Explain what happens now going forward with all of these moving parts, mortgage interest deductions, college endowments, 401ks. Every single one of these little things that we talked about have an army of lobbyists behind it to try to close or open the loophole that they want.
The most vivid image that a Republican gave me, this is a member of Ways and Means. He said, it's going to be a knife fight over the next couple of days. So we have that to look forward to. But you're right. The lobbyists will come out in full force. Organizations are already putting out statements. As soon as tomorrow, we could see an updated version of this bill from Chairman Brady. That's known as the chairman's mark. Potentially, that could slide into the weekend, depending on how many tweaks they need to make. But that will be the version that they will then take to the committee next week and begin working through. So this is kind of the starting bid for them. You can expect to see some changes. Again, those state and local tax deductions, for example, that's one where we're probably going to see a lot of back and forth on. You mentioned college endowments. There's a 1.4% tax on endowment income for wealthy schools in this bill. That is absolutely going to bring the lobbyists out. When previous proposals like this got around to colleges earlier this year, there were meetings. The president of Harvard came and met with Republican leadership about this. So that's another good example of sort of where the hackles are going to be raised.
The opening bid from House Republicans on major tax cuts, they're also calling it tax reform. This is just the start because the Senate, the president, the lobbyists, and all of the interest groups will get involved. Colleen Murphy, tax reporter at Bloomberg, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. It's Todd Zwillick. The Mueller investigation did not stop on Monday when indictments were handed down. It continues, but there's a lot to be learned from the story in those charges, the story that they tell. The indictment against former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his close associate Rick Gates reveals a web of international transfers and offshore bank accounts, all allegedly put in place to facilitate the flow of over $75 million. According to prosecutors, it's a window into a world of international money laundering, one that's gotten increased attention with revelations like Manafort's work in Ukraine and also document leaks like the Panama Papers. Ilya Lazovsky is editor at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and we wanted him to help explain just how international money laundering can work at this level.
Well, it sure is complicated, and these schemes often are for a good reason, because they're supposed to be complicated, so they're hard to trace. But basically what happened is that Paul Manafort and his associate did work for the former president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, and his political party. And the way they were paid for this work is by receiving money not directly into their bank accounts in the U.S. or anywhere else, but into a series of offshore firms, mostly in Cyprus, as well as in a few other places. And then from there, they would have these Cyprus firms wire transactions directly to vendors in the United States to buy property for various, you know, home automation, lighting companies, a rug store in Virginia. And so that way they could avoid paying taxes on the money. They could avoid kind of owning it themselves. And instead it would pass through these this offshore entity.
And let's stress that this 12-count indictment has been released against these two gentlemen. They're innocent of these charges until proven guilty. But Ilya, why Cyprus? It's been reported that Cyprus is a favorite banking destination for Russians hoping to spirit money out of their country. Why use it here, allegedly?
Well, it's, you know, these are always going to be speculations. We don't know why they chose specifically Cyprus. Probably it's because Cyprus, as you said, has been a favorite destination, not just for Russian, but for people throughout the former Soviet Union, including Ukraine. So if Paul Manafort is collaborating, working with, being paid by these kind of people, they have connections, they have registration agents and lawyers that they're familiar with that can make these connections. They know what they're doing. This is just speculation, but presumably they were advised that this is how we do things and this is what we suggest for you to do.
And what about the alleged ties to U.S. lobbying firms here? Not just Manafort in on the act, but lobbying firms, we now presume Mercury LLC and the Podesta Group in the indictment, companies A and B, getting paid through offshore accounts themselves.
Yeah, this is just a sort of another element of this scheme. It's interesting that not only were the Podesta Group and Mercury paid from these offshore accounts, but the contracts they signed to do the job wasn't even with Manafort or Gates. It was with now defunct organization in Brussels called the European Center for a Modern Ukraine. You know, you can launder money. You can also, in a sense, launder contracts or connections. This is how the Podesta Group and Mercury were able to say, we are not dealing on behalf of a foreign government because really we're getting this contract from this think tank in Brussels. That's how they justified not registering as a foreign agent. And in the indictment, it actually says this is how they justify, this is the these are the talking points they were using to defend themselves when these things were reported last year. The talking points literally said, look, don't ask me about these contracts or these payments or the work. I literally just introduced these people to one another. You know, the client, Podesta Group and Mercury, their client is this think tank in Brussels, when really it was allegedly Manafort and Gates who were doing the work.
Well, Ilya, all of this movement of millions through offshore accounts and shell companies, is the ability to do this an inevitable symptom of a financial system that you want to be fluid? I mean, you want legitimate money to be able to move relatively easily so that it enables commerce. But are there inherent weaknesses in a financial system where people can use layers and layers of shell companies, allegedly, and move money through this country or that country and hide financial crimes?
Absolutely. Of course, you want to be able to move money around the world. Our global economy couldn't work without it. But the problem is the lack of transparency. And it's, I should stress, it's not just Cyprus. This happens in the UK. This happens in Delaware. This happens in other jurisdictions all over the world. And in a sense, this financial system, which allows our economy to exist, is also enabling some really unscrupulous actors who are operating in countries with weak rule of law, sometimes with authoritarian regimes. It's sort of a political economic nexus that allows them to steal money from the state budget, from their own people. Then they don't want to keep the money in those countries, so they want to move it somewhere safe. And they launder it through these offshores, and then it ends up in the West, invested in properties in New York, in London, in Florida. And now it's protected in a democratic country with rule of law. And of course, the financial system is enabling this kind of behavior. And we really need to look at transparency and improving the ability to track these flows. And it, as I said, it's not just Cyprus. London is actually a very particularly notorious center where this kind of activity goes on.
Well, are any lawmakers in the UK or the United States gunning for more transparency? And who fights against it when they try?
There have been some initiatives, I think, in both countries, partially in response to reporting that my organization, OCCRP, and others have done. I think the rules have been tightened gradually over the years, but it's just not an issue that is easy to explain to people. One of the challenges of reporting on this topic is just how complicated this is. And of course, that's the design. So it's hard to explain this as an issue, as a rallying cry, especially when people see it as something that doesn't concern them immediately. And of course, there are always business interests calling for as few restrictions as possible. People talk about privacy. People talk about, you know, the ability to conduct legitimate business transactions in a way that protects their privacy. And of course, you have to balance these things. There's no easy solution or it would have been done by now. But you have to really take a look at the damage that's happening here also.
The complicated web of offshore banking and shell companies that can enable money laundering. Ilya Lisovsky, editor at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we want to return now to our ongoing coverage of the future of work in a time of changing technology. Our friends over at Retro Report have been collaborating with Quartz on a new series. It's called What Happens Next? And this week, like us, they're looking at the future of work. Automation and artificial intelligence, those mean that jobs are changing and in more ways and in more cases, disappearing. This week's episode of this documentary series looks at the dangerous occupation of logging as a way to understand the risks and even the potential benefits of machines replacing humans.
I've come to the belief that the only way I can ensure the safety of my people is not have them there. The best way not to kill a hand cutter is not have one.
That's Eric Kroom. He's a self-taught engineer and founder of Kroom Logging, featured in the mini-documentary. He built a machine to replace his own workers, making logging safer, as he says, but also, let's face it, a lot more profitable. Clive Thompson is a journalist who covers technology with Smithsonian Magazine, with Wired, and the New York Times Magazine, and he joins us to talk about the future of work.
It's going to mean that there's a lot of automation of what they typically think of as kind of brain work or cognitive work, right? I mean, the automation story of the last 100 years has been using robots and machines to replace muscle work. But now we're talking about AI that can do stuff that typically you thought only a human could do sitting thinking at a desk, you know, legal work, writing work, analysis. And so what that really means is that the sort of the AI and automation revolution is going to move up the org chart, and it's going to affect entirely new classes of workers.
So is that what's different now? I mean, technology and automation, as you suggested, replacing humans is a force that's as old as technology itself, certainly as old as industrialization. We saw the coal industry automate, the auto industry automate, fewer jobs. But you're saying this coming wave of automation is fundamentally different.
Exactly, because the fact that we're talking about thinking, you know, something that we would normally have assumed, you know, only humans can kind of do, it allows for a much more rapid replacement of a type of cognitive work. Like, for example, the other day, a radiologist was on Twitter saying, okay, I've been using machine learning to help recognize whether or not there is cancer in lung scans, right? Like CAT scans of lungs. And he said, you know, I've discovered that it's actually better on average than humans detecting whether or not there's cancer. So his question was, and this is an honest one, should I recommend that any young person go into, you know, radiology when it might simply be something better done in the next 10 years by AI?
Well, what about the opportunities here? I mean, the risks are clear. Fewer jobs, less work, major economic risk. What are some of the potential upsides? What are some of the potential advantages here?
I think we might be surprised, frankly. In fact, I can predict that we are going to be surprised by the upsides, because it's always really, really hard to figure out or to predict when you're in the moment what new forms of work are going to emerge as we go along. I mean, if you were to think about it this way, you know, if you went back, you know, the 100 years or so, and you were in the U.S. and you saw how many people were working on farms, such a huge chunk of the American population was working on farms. All of those jobs got automated over the last 100 years, but, you know, it didn't cause massive unemployment because new forms of work emerged, you know, sorts of secretarial jobs or clerical jobs or jobs in cities, you know, serving food. And the same thing has happened even in the last 10 years with technology. If you went back 10 or 15 years and said, well, you know, what types of work are going to be huge in 2017, no one would have predicted something even as trivial as, say, WordPress blog consultant. I know tons of people who make a really good living literally just tweaking and improving and creating WordPress sites for companies. That job category didn't exist 15 years ago because WordPress didn't exist 15 years ago. It was an automation technology that created an entirely new class of pretty well-paid, terrific jobs. So I think we're always going to be surprised if you were to ask me, so what type of job 15 years from now will be possible because we have AI? You know, I honestly don't know. But the one thing I can say is there will be new jobs that we can't imagine right now, because every time we're given new abilities by machines, we sort of manage to come up with entirely new forms of work that would have seemed crazy or impossible or unthinkable even 15 or 20 years earlier.
And isn't there a long history of predictions of calamity for not only economies, but for humans' ability to work because new technology was coming online?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you go back to look at predictions in the late 19th and early 20th century that we would be living entire lives of leisure because everything would have been automated, and that didn't happen. I mean, really, I think the biggest thing we have to worry about is not the distant future, but the near term, because we also know from history that, you know, when you look at the Luddites and you look at automation in the 19th century, it destroyed a lot of jobs, and things were pretty bad for several decades because it took a few decades for automation to create the new jobs, to create the factory jobs that began improving lives and improving salaries. You go 30 or 40 years into the Industrial Revolution, and you know, and actually wages did start rising and start rising rapidly, but there was a several decade long adjustment period. And if we're at the beginning of that right now, then what that means is you could be saying to someone who's like 27, okay, AI is coming. It's going to get rid of your job. Don't worry. We'll have it figured out by the time you're 57. And that's not much comfort to an entire generation of people that have to live through the transition.
Clive Thompson, thanks for being with us.
I enjoyed it.
Clive Thompson covers technology for Smithsonian, for Wired, and for the New York Times Magazine.
This is Bree from Portland, Oregon. About 3 years ago, I made the switch from working in corporate America, long hours, commute, hectic lifestyle, expectations that were just unrealistic, to working for a consulting firm where I work out of my home. Could not be happier. I have the most supportive management ever. I have lots of flexibility, and frankly, I'm a whole lot better at my job now.
My name is Wash, and I'm from San Diego, California. Anyone who has been in the same job for 10 years is likely to be out of touch with modern job markets, let alone the future. How about asking folks who have spent the last 10 years bouncing between 8 to 12 different part-time jobs with no security or benefits what they think about the future of work? The future of work is automation. And unless automation comes with benefits for workers it replaces, automation is just more corporate welfare and greed.
Your concerns and anxieties about the future of work with the rise of technology. We got this from Miami, Florida. I've automated myself out of 4 jobs in as many years. Someone please make me stop. We want your voice in this conversation. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always comment on our Facebook page.
Here's a ground ball right side. Could do it. The Houston Astros are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
There's the call from Joe Buck on Fox last night. A historic end to a thrilling series. The Houston Astros went toe-to-toe with the best team in baseball and came out on top, beating the LA Dodgers 5-1 in Game 7 in Los Angeles last night. Eric Bright is the director of radio operations at KERA, and he helped us out when we were broadcasting from Dallas last week. But Eric is also a Houston native, and as we learned last week, a lifelong suffering Houston Astros fan. Eric, how are you feeling the morning after?
Oh, it's a good day for an expat Houstonian like myself, but I'm still processing.
I'll bet you are. You know, Eric, you're a long-suffering fan, as I mentioned. I know that you were there your whole life for a lot of past hopes, a lot of disappointments with the Astros. Talk about that.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, my baseball consciousness really starts in about 1973. And, you know, throughout the 70s, well, it's just a team throughout my life that has been known more for, I guess, their, you know, for their crazy uniforms and the building they played in, rather than the baseball they played. But it's so nice to have finally just get a win. Wow. It's hard to say.
I mean, there have been times in the past when the Astros have made the playoffs, they've come close to a win or two only to have the dream snatched away.
Oh, 1986 comes to mind specifically for, I think, still one of, well, the greatest National League Championship Series against the Mets, and the Mets pulled it out, and of course they end up beating the Red Sox in a crazy World Series, but that was the Astros' year, I thought. That was, you know, great pitching staff. Nolan Ryan and Mike Scott were just unhittable. And then the late 90s Astros, the Bagwell and Biggio and Ken Caminiti and Lance Berkman Astros of the late 90s that always had a good regular season and then just, you know, frittered out at the end. And then the 05 Astros that played the White Sox finally made it to the World Series. And I think I told you this story last week. When the Astros won the NL championship, I got online and bought the championship t-shirt. And by the time it got delivered, well, it got delivered the day after they got swept by the White Sox. So I've never even worn the t-shirt. It's 12 years old sitting up in a, you know, up in a cabinet.
Well, you can take it out now and maybe give it a wear around the house. Eric, before we let you go, Houston gets a win after the devastation of Hurricane Harvey. Look, it's just baseball, but it's a great moment for your city.
Yeah, yeah, it's, you know, I haven't lived there in some time, but I have family and friends there, and of course, yeah, that hurricane, that was devastating, and you know, this is a little, it's a little mood lifter. That's really what it is, and a great team effort, and it's just very exciting for the city.
Eric Bright, I'm jealous. My Nationals went out in the first round, but I'm happy for you and for Houston Astro fans. I think a lot of Americans are, Eric, so congratulations. Eric Bright, Director of Radio Operations at KERA in Dallas, Texas.
Thanks.
Well, this World Series really seems to have tugged at your heartstrings across the country.
Hey, my name is Mark from San Juan Capistrano. I just finished watching this World Series. Yeah, I'm a Dodger fan, but I gotta tell you, to see the Astros win, they've never won before. It was of baseball, the dimensions of the mathematics of baseball. It was a beautiful thing to watch.
Hi, this is Cherie from Elmira, Oregon. I'm sorry, even being a native born Los Angeles person, go Houston. They deserved it. Los Angeles has won before. Hoorah! It was a killer game.
They deserved it. Houston deserved it. And let's get to the bottom line, folks. The Astros outplayed the Dodgers last night. One team wanted that more. There's no question about it. And the Astros came on top. Jose Altuve and the team from Houston. Tell us how you feel about this year's World Series. Any bitter Dodgers fans out there? Are you just happy for Houston? Call us 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.